Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and joining us on the program today is Anna Bodkin. Her new book is The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. She joins us by telephone from Philadelphia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Anna, before we get into this book, I'd like to know a little bit about you, because from what I understand, you report about people living in extremis. Is that a correct terminology?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in the global south. My global south was very far to the north geographically. I was born in Leningrad, USSR, just below the polar circle. So I'm very familiar with both the life in a totalitarian state, with life in a state of depravity, of poverty, and at the same time with the enormous gift of camaraderie and friendship and beauty that can be born within such precarious conditions. So, you know, I grew up walking through doors of people who scraped by, and then when I became a journalist and a writer, I continued to walk through these doors where doors existed, or where they exist, mm-hmm. just in a more professional function. And I think I am, you know, I live in the United States now, or am based in the United States now. I have spent most of my life living and working in the global south, and I feel that I am sort of a mediator between these two very connected worlds that shape each other.
And you've been reporting and writing about Afghanistan for about 12 years, which is about the time that we had our invasion.
That's correct. I first came to Afghanistan just before invasion in 2001.
This new book is set in Afghanistan, and somehow you found this little community that's literally out in the middle of nowhere. Tell us about it.
The village of Oka has about 240 inhabitants who live in 40 homes made with mud and straw in the middle of the concave desert that stretches from the Hindu Kush north toward the Oxus River, now called the Amudarya River, which marks Afghanistan's border in the north. And it's a very remote village, very, on the one hand, physically disconnected from the rest of the country. For example, the nearest sizable town is about 7.5 hours walk away, and there are no roads between the village and the town. There are no cars in the village. People who want to get to the town have to walk or take a donkey. But at the same time, Vic, it's a very, it's a community that to me epitomizes Afghanistan, because 80% of Afghanistan is rural. So 80% of Afghans live in conditions that more or less resemble the conditions of Oka. Of course, Oka is a little bit extreme because in addition to being so remote, it also has absolutely no irrigation, so nothing grows there. So there's no subsistence farming going on. The two sources of income for the villagers are, for men and boys, collecting caliganum, which is this kind of dry desert thistle-like brush, which they then trade as kindling for rice and oil and wheat flour in villages nearby. And for women, carpet weaving. So in these completely destitute conditions, women produce the most beautiful carpets in the world. And when I came to Oka in 2010, I was so pierced by the dissonance between the violence around the village and between the poverty inside the village and the beauty that is created, that comes from this amalgamation of depravity and danger and poverty, that I felt like I needed to return and spend enough time to watch a part of it. So this book is about the four seasons of one carpet.
And you had your base in a big city nearby, but you kept going back to the village, and there was one particular family that welcomed you there, and a woman named Thara who was getting ready to make a rug.
Yes, I stayed in Mazar-e-Sharif, which is the largest city in northern Afghanistan, and I made forays to Oka. The thing was that Afghanistan in 2011, northern Afghanistan in 2011, was fairly rapidly being overrun by insurgents. So I had to be very flexible and fairly mobile in my research, because just living in Oka would have put my hosts in tremendous danger. You know, even when I cover the way Afghan women cover, even when I wear a veil, people know who I am. News travels much faster than donkeys somehow through the Afghan desert. So I would have been a threat, a security threat to my hosts. That's why I had to be a little bit more mobile than I would have preferred to be. But the book focuses on the family of this carpet weaver named Thara, who is a wonderful woman, just a little younger than me. She has now three children and a husband, and she lives with her husband and her husband's parents, Baba Nazar, who is a hunter and a village elder, and Bostan, spelled like the city on the American Northeast. It means garden in Turkmen, who is Baba Nazar's wife and sort of the matriarch of the family.
Bostan is quite a person.
Bostan was a delight. She was probably in her late 60s. Afghanistan really knows how old they are, because nobody really wants to count of privation. But I'm guessing that she was late 60s just by what she was describing to me and how old her children were and how old she said she was when she was married. And she was constantly looking for ways to make the world a better place. She reminded me a lot of my paternal great aunt, who always was something, fixing something, cooking something, taking care of somebody, cleaning the house, you know. And Bostan, took a liking to me, and she would call me her older sister, which was an honorific, and it was extremely humbling.
And all the girls and women in the community had the word flower in their name?
Standard names for Turkmen girls would incorporate the word gul, which is flower. So some girls are named A Thousand Flowers. Some girls are named Friday Flower, Red Flower. So I was surrounded in this village that grows absolutely nothing because it has no irrigation. I was actually surrounded by flowers.
Oh, my. And in this village, they had two wells, but the water wasn't clean. The water was dirty and polluted, and there's hardly any food to eat. There's no drugs. There's no health care. A lot of them would buy opium because it was cheaper than food to keep their babies from crying. This is just a tragic thing.
Afghanistan can be a tragic story. I sometimes think of this country, you know, it has 29 or 30 million people, and it's a country of 29 or 30 million tragedies. And that's one way of looking at it. But I think another very important way of looking at it is that it also is a country of 30 million incredible survivors who persevere in the direst of circumstances. And to me, working in places like Afghanistan, it gives me so much hope in our survival as humans, not just physical survival, but also the survival of the inner beauty, you want to call it heart or soul or whatever you prefer, and whatever your philosophy dictates. How do we manage to remain kind to one another, to continue to create beauty, to continue to fall in love, to continue to bear children in the direst conditions. So at the same time, while Afghanistan is a very sad story, Afghanistan is also a very beautiful story of survival.
Anna Bodkin joins us. Her book is The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. And this is really a beautifully written book. You have so many wonderful descriptions of what you're seeing, of the world through your eyes in this place. It's really an amazing world.
Thank you very much. It is an amazing world. Our world is quite full of beauty and surprises. Afghanistan is a gorgeous, gorgeous land. And I do love the desert. I grew up in very flat marshland in a very cold place, so I'm quite fond of hot places that are also flat and dry.
Yeah. Okay, so 12 years ago, we invaded this country like so many other countries have done before. We decided that we could go into Afghanistan and do what we wanted to do there. And besides our supposed goal of finding Osama bin Laden, who wasn't there anymore by the time we found him, we heard a lot of our congressmen here talking about how we were going in there to help the women of Afghanistan. How have we helped them 12 years later? How are things better for the women in Afghanistan?
Very marginally and for very few women. The changes in Afghanistan that were brought out by the billions of aid dollars that we have pumped and the West has pumped into the country mostly congregated in cities, well, mostly probably congregated in pockets of corrupt politicians, but mostly you see changes in cities, that's where some women walk around without covering their face. That's where some girls go to school. That's where some women, not a lot, have jobs outside the home. But most of Afghanistan doesn't just remain very traditional, but has really received none or very, very little of this aid money. So, for example, if you look at the village of Oka, the only change that really is life-changing for it is that some people have been able to buy cell phones, and there is a cell phone tower in a nearby village that works. So sometimes, most of the time, you can call out or into Oka, but there still is no clean water. One in four Afghan children die before the age of five. It's the highest infant mortality rate in the world, just as it was before the U.S. invasion. One in eight women die in childbirth. So the hypocrisy of arguing that somehow women are benefiting from this invasion is actually stunning, because the reason things aren't changing for the better for the women of Afghanistan, they're just as hungry, just as impoverished, just as ill because they have no access to sanitation or clean water or medical care. And so much of it is as a result of the war that we are continuing to fight on Afghanistan's soil. You know, these infrastructures that are not being put in place are not being put in place because it's a country in conflict.
And with that being said, when we do ultimately withdraw all of our troops, it's probably going to be even worse, isn't it?
Afghanistan has been spinning very rapidly toward a rekindled civil war. When the United States invaded Afghanistan or sent troops to Afghanistan or NATO troops into Afghanistan in 2001, Afghanistan was in the state of civil war, and that is returning. In addition to the Taliban, there are other militias that are competing for territory, competing for power. When NATO withdraws in 2014, it's very possible that the last buffer between various warring militias will be removed, and Afghanistan will probably descend into an all-out civil war, which, of course, will not benefit Afghan women in the least.
The book is The World is a Carpet, Thara's Carpet. We follow the course of its creation and all the difficulty that's involved. She's running out of a particular kind of thread, and it's this beautiful thing, and she ends up making a couple hundred dollars for about a year's work. And it's an amazing story to hear about this rug, because it's over a million knots, and the neighbors come in and they help work on it, and it's just a communal thing, isn't it?
It's a communal thing, and I thought it was a great thread to connect my friends in the village of Okai and my audience here in the States, because I imagine that a lot of people, including some of our listeners now, probably have an Afghan carpet in their home. And so now they can touch it and know what went into it and how it was woven, and imagine a whole village weaving it, and imagine the babies that were born on it. And I think that it's such a great way to remind ourselves how small our world is and how connected we are and how responsible we are for each other, for one another.
I love so many of your accounts in this book. And you had this guy who was your driver for quite a while, and then he kept getting more and more nervous, and he had his old gun that he kept getting closer and closer to his hands because he was so nervous, and finally he just decided he wasn't going to drive you anymore. So you get this other guy who has a taxi, and you're looking for the village, and you're trying to decide where to turn because there's no road, and you say, okay, turn here. And you just start driving in a straight line just out in the middle of nowhere. There are no landmarks that you recognize. And by some miracle, you arrive at the village.
That's pretty much what Afghanistan is. You hold your breath and hope for the best.
I love that story. And then the cab gets stuck, and you end up having to be saved by some guy with a tractor who's the cab driver's father. And this guy, you go to his place. That was a mine.
The Afghan AAA. You call a tractor, and thank goodness for those cell phone towers. I've traveled a lot around the world as a journalist on Deadline. I used to work for the San Francisco Chronicle and covered wars for the paper and conflicts and catastrophes. You travel on Deadline, you have to file a story in the evening. You miss so much because you are so determined to get your story and get out and get to your laptop and get to your satellite phone and file. Once that deadline is removed, you can actually allow yourself the luxury of being stuck, of having your car be stuck, and then watch what happens. And inevitably, because we are so incredibly generous with one another in this world, inevitably somebody comes to your rescue, be that a tractor, or at first the people of Okai were considering hitching a few camels to the car, but the car was really, really deep in sand. So somebody will come, and then you end up having dinner with your rescue team and talking about war or talking about stars. I think at one point I returned to the house of the driver's father, and we had a long conversation about various different constellations in the sky.
And you met the historian there.
I met the brother. Okay, we're getting into some deep family connections. Uh-huh. I met the brother of the father of the young man who was working with me as a driver, was called by his fellow villagers the historian, because he collected histories of pretty much everything. He had scrapbooks in which he kept notations about important historical events, important in his opinion. So right next to the first presidential election in Afghanistan was a notation of a killer storm during which two of his fellow villagers died from fright in the desert, or the marriage between one of his neighbors and children and then another daughter of somebody else. So the level of global importance of his histories varied, but to him they were all equally meaningful. He too was addicted to opium, and if he spent a long time in his company, he would start around lunchtime, or maybe he would start earlier, I don't know, but he would start taking little bits of opium to chew, and then by the end of the day he would retreat into himself and sort of sit in the corner with his eyes closed, stoned, mm-hmm. and periodically perk up and react to something that was being said in the room. Wow. Usually something meaningful, but not always. Sometimes it was like waking him up from an opiate dream.
Anna Bodkin joins us. Anna, I heard a rumor that you're getting ready to go to Mali. What are you working on?
Oh, it's not a rumor. I actually am returning to Mali. I'm working there this year. I'm herding cattle with some Fulani nomads. So I'm taking a very long walk around the inner delta of the Niger River in Mali with a small family of nomads and their cows.
This is the next book?
This is the next book, yes.
What is that like?
Amazing, intimidating. I always feel when I work inadequate to the incredible pain that I see, to the amazing generosity that I encounter, inadequate to the feet that we walk past. And I think it's a good thing. I think it keeps me alert and vulnerable to people's stories and get too big in the head.
This is another very ancient area, another trade route area. You've got Timbuktu in that area, right?
Yes, that's right. I'm just a little bit to the south of Timbuktu.
A very ancient area, and another one where we have Islamic extremism that's really impacting the region.
It is probably the last, or rather the latest, front line in the global war on terror, Mali. Yes, yes, that is interesting. I'm walking with people who have been walking since the beginning of time, like in that Patty and Rogers poem. So they have... They're very familiar with crossing all sorts of lines, artificially drawn borders, front lines, water rights lines, rivers, pastures, farms. And it's very interesting to see the world as it changes in very many ways, you know, both due to war and the reckless way the West pursues natural resources, the global warming, the climate change. It's interesting to listen to my nomadic hosts explain what is happening to the land around them, because they know that land so well. They have walked every inch of it behind their cows.
Is the deforestation what they're talking about? What is the issue as far as the...
Everything, desertification, pent-up violence between the farmers and the nomads. They're talking about... The change in water levels as a result of climate change and desertification and absolutely irresponsible farming policies of the colonial West Africa then and post-colonial West Africa, expansion of farms. So there are a lot of various different lines of friction, if you want to call it that, that my hosts have to navigate, and they do it beautifully, very gracefully.
Anna Bodkin has been our guest on the program. Her new book is The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. And when you're in Mali, does your cell phone work there too?
Sometimes, depending on where I'm walking.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I just turn it off.
I loved it in this book when the little kid comes up to you and he's trying to get you to give him a cell phone card, and you didn't really understand what he was talking about initially. He wanted this card that had Turkmen music on it.
He wanted essentially a memory card, a 2 gigabyte memory card for his cell phone. And frankly, Vic, my cell phone, which is what we're talking on right now, it's like a rotary cell phone. I don't know these terms. I didn't know that such a thing existed as a memory card that you can put into your cell phone in addition to your SIM card, and that it would play music for you. Actually, Fulani also use those cards. They actually buy cell phones without a SIM card. They don't need the SIM card. They have nobody to call. But what they do is they buy memory cards with Fulani music on it, and then they put these cell phones on the lanyards and hang them from their necks and walk around through the Sahel listening to these mini boomboxes on their chests. It's wonderful.
It's amazing to look at the disparity between what we consider to be such primitive culture in these countries and then the fact that they're walking around playing their music.
Oh, it's not primitive at all. It's extraordinarily complex. It's just not something a lot of people in the West are used to, but we're here not that far removed, and the world is actually a fairly small place. So we're all woven into it together. It's good to remember that. You know, when I was working in Ilkha in Afghanistan, and I couldn't understand how she was producing that gorgeous carpet using those things. What was she doing? I couldn't wrap my mind around it because it was so absolutely incredible. And I'm not very good at doing small things with my hands. And then she would look up and she would watch me scribble in my notepad. And of course, she can't read or write. So what I was doing to her was equally unknowable.
Mm.
And we didn't talk very much. But sometimes, from time to time, our eyes would meet and we would read one another's thoughts and we would laugh because we realized that to each of us, the other's craft was so foreign and so amazingly complicated. And to each of us, what we did was sort of, you know, this is what we do.
Mm.
I think it's useful to look at somebody who does something you've never seen before and ponder that.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Vic, so much for having me.
Our guest has been Anna Bodkin. Her book, The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.